Right, as I said, this morning's work is on Mark chapter 12. Well, actually, in fact, Mark chapter 11, verse 27, till the end of chapter 12. Before we dive into that passage, I think it's worth trying to set the scene for a few minutes to establish where we've got to and what is going to happen next, so we can see how this chapter fits into the context of Mark. What we've seen is that since Peter's recognition of Jesus as the Messiah in Mark chapter 8, Jesus has been wandering around teaching the disciples, and he's been teaching the disciples two main things. He's been teaching the disciples what sort of Messiah he is, not just the Messiah come in glory, but the Messiah, the suffering servant. And he's been teaching the disciples what sort of lives they therefore should live, what it means to be a disciple of a Messiah who is a suffering servant, living, as it were, in this world before he comes again in glory. We now get to a turning point in the second half of Mark with the entry into Jerusalem. In the beginning of chapter 11, Jesus enters Jerusalem as king in fulfillment of the prophecy made in Zechariah 9:9 that the king would come riding on an ass. He does just that in his entry to Jerusalem. One of the most overt public acts that he is indeed the Messiah, I think, that occurs in Mark's Gospel. And one of the things we have to know is, well, why is he coming so overtly as king into Jerusalem, into the capital? And that is something we will try to answer later on. What we are doing now is we are coming to the climax of Mark. Everybody says that the last chapters of all the Gospels are the climax. Everybody knows that much more time is spent on the last week of Jesus' ministry than of any other period in his life. In fact, in Mark, 5.5 chapters are spent on the last week, 10 chapters on the first 3 years. So certainly the writers of the Gospels were very conscious of the fact that they were reaching a climax, and they went to lengths, therefore, to give us detail that we might understand the nature of this climax. To fully understand the nature of the climax, we've got to also put ourselves in the shoes of the disciples and of the crowds. The disciples, you will remember, knowing that he was going up to Jerusalem, were fearful. And yet there must have been a hint of anticipation there, a wondering of what was going to happen when the Messiah entered Jerusalem. The crowds singing Hosanna as he wandered in on the ass must similarly have had at least a wonder as to what was going to happen with, even if they hadn't realized it was a Messiah, a prophet coming to Jerusalem after so many years. What happens then when he comes into Jerusalem? Well, just running through the chapters, the first thing which happens after he's had a quick look around is he cleanses the temple in between the cursing of the fig tree. He then has a whole chapter, the chapter we're going to look at today, on a dispute and teaching against the religious authorities. He then has a chapter of teaching the disciples in chapter 13. And then we get the two chapters on the crucifixion, and finally a small chapter on the resurrection. So that's the layout of the time that he is going to spend in Jerusalem. When we look at that, we realize that though classically everybody says what is at the climax is the crucifixion, in fact, the crucifixion is only taking up about half the time that Mark allocates to this climax section of the Gospel. And the other half is teaching. And therefore, to understand the nature of this climax, we've got to understand what is being taught. It is also worth noting at this point that the public teaching, which we're looking at in chapter 12, is the longest unit of public teaching that has occurred since Jesus called the disciples in Mark chapter 3. Dick said yesterday, quite rightly, that in the second half of Mark, we're getting less and less emphasis on the crowds. More and more, the teaching of the disciples is coming to the fore. And yet chapters 12 stands out as the exception to this rule. It is the exception not just to the second half, but as I said, to the whole of the first half. The only time that Jesus has been speaking more in public, doing more in public, has been before the rejection in chapter 3, verse 6, when the authorities decided to kill him. We therefore need to ask why there is this public teaching, this long stretch of ministry in public. It gives us a clue to know what it's all about, to notice the nature of this public teaching. It occurs in its entirety. It is dealing with the religious authorities. It is all either a debate with, disputes with, or teaching against the religious authorities in one form or another. I don't think we will understand this chapter until we realize that this is a battle that is being fought between Jesus and the religious authorities, and it is a battle which Jesus is taking the initiative in. This is something which hasn't occurred before in the conflicts between Jesus and the religious authorities. But here he's taking the initiative. He's taking the initiative in chapter 11, verse 15, when he comes and cleanses the temple. In some ways, an unprovoked act. He takes the initiative again in the parable at the beginning of chapter 12, when he has really ended the discussion which has been raised at the end of chapter 11:27, when the chief priests, elders and scribes come and ask him about the authority. He has ended that question at one level satisfactorily, and yet he doesn't let it rest there. He moves it one stage further, because it is part of what he's doing in the campaign of this battle that he is fighting against them. Again, as we will see in more detail later on, in chapter 12, verses 35 to 37, and again in 38 to 40, we have two instances where he has unprovokedly launched teaching attacks against the scribes. Right, with that introduction and scene setting, let's look now in more detail at the nature of this battle, which is at the heart of the passage. There are three questions which we need to ask ourselves and to answer about the battle, and I will structure the rest of this morning's talk around those three questions. The three questions are, firstly, what is the significance of the battle? In other words, why did it happen? Secondly, how does the battle fit into the overall story that Mark is telling of Jesus' life and ministry? And thirdly, what exactly is the battle over? What issue is it being fought around? I will be spending most of my time on the last of these three questions. That's just a warning. Right, let's look at the first question then, which is, what is the significance of the battle? To understand the significance of the battle, we have to look at the incident which occurred just before this morning's passage, which we're looking at. This is the cursing of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple, and we will be looking at it in more depth in the study groups immediately after this session. But it is in fact an integral part of 11:27 onwards. Here he shows that he has come as king, we saw earlier, to judge Israel. The fig tree was an allegorical picture in the Old Testament of Israel. And the cursing of the fig tree would have been understood, at least in retrospect by the disciples, as a cursing of Israel. The fact that Mark interleaves the cleansing of the temple in the middle of what is happening to the fig tree is just Mark ramming home the point that this is indeed what he is doing. He is saying, Jesus has come as king and as Messiah to judge and to reject Israel. The judgment and the rejection is not something which happens suddenly. It is the beginning of a process that will culminate inevitably in destruction, unless Israel repents, which we know she didn't. But it is a process which will occur, just as for the fig tree, it was cursed one day, dead the next. So for Israel, temple cleansed, and what happens next, yet to be seen. We have another description, really, of what Jesus is doing here in the parable in the beginning of chapter 12, where we know the story well. A man leaves a vineyard in the possession of tenants, goes away, and then expects some reward, some fruit, for the rent of this vineyard. And he sends his servants, and no fruit is forthcoming. Instead, they are killed. Finally, he sends his son. No fruit is forthcoming. And because no fruit is forthcoming, but instead the death of his son, so follows the destruction of the tenants. A parable really explaining what Jesus is doing in coming into Jerusalem. So we see that the battle that we are looking at in chapter 12 is part of this rejection judgment scene. And we have to ask what part of this judgment rejection scene it is. And it is, as I understand it, a record of how the Son came into Jerusalem looking for fruit and not finding any. And as a record of the Son not finding any fruit, it is giving the reason for judgment. Because we have to ask and answer questions like, what was the fruit that the Son was looking for? In what way was it not forthcoming? I mean, it's obvious to see how it wasn't forthcoming on a fig tree. But in what way was it not forthcoming in Israel? Well, that's precisely what chapter 12 is telling us. And that is what we will look at. It's obviously an important issue because the rejection by God of his people is not a minor event. It is a major event of immense proportions. It is something which God has warned about and threatened and given repeated chances for Israel to turn away from for centuries. But now it is beginning to happen. And so we need to look at it, and we need to look at it asking ourselves whether there are lessons for us to learn from this. The second question which we need to ask ourselves then is, how does this battle fit into the context of what Mark is telling us about Jesus' life and ministry? Because we're really looking at a slightly different slant of Mark's story here from what we normally look at. Normally, as you've obviously been aware, we've been looking at Jesus, who he is, the sort of Messiah he is, what he's been doing with the disciples. But here we have a slightly different strand coming out. Nonetheless, a major strand, I think. And that is the strand of conflict. We've had conflict with the religious authorities from as early as chapter 2, where, if you remember the first conference, the authorities rejected Jesus for a variety of reasons. They rejected him increasingly, just arguing against him and arguing against him, until the decision came in chapter 3, verse 6, that they would kill him because they could not accept what he was doing. His response then to their rejection in chapter 3, as you remember, was to withdraw. He withdrew, called the 12 disciples, and in effect set up, founded a new Israel. The conflict with the religious authorities then continues through the middle chapters of Mark. Chapter 7, we get the conflict. Chapter 8, we get the conflict. Chapter 10, we get the conflict. And now the conflict takes a new turn. Because in those chapters, what had happened was the authorities had come to Jesus rejecting him. Now he comes to Jerusalem rejecting them. And it has taken, I think, a major turn at this point. And it has one more step to be played out, which we will see tomorrow, when in response, well, not in response, but as a culmination of their side of the battle, they kill him. But this is the culmination of his side of the battle, in his rejection and judgment of them. So, it is the climax of the theme of conflict. And this is something we shouldn't be surprised about. Mark has been introducing these themes through his gospel, not just as themes starting nowhere and going nowhere, but as themes, at least in many instances, started with an ultimate objective, which now, in these closing chapters of Mark, he is winding up. They have achieved their purpose. This is what it was all about. I mean, that's after all what a theme is. A theme is something, a strand which is running through a much longer interval of time or of an argument than you can encompass with a short passage. And so Mark is now drawing to a conclusion this theme of conflict. Now, standing back then and beginning to draw together some of these threads that we have been seeing, we see that one of the major themes in Mark's gospel has been the rejection of the old Israel and the establishment of a new Israel in its place. Now, this is something which I think is of considerable importance. We get a hint of it in the parable at the beginning of chapter 12. The parable, incidentally, at the beginning of chapter 12 is a superb summary of Jesus' coming into Jerusalem, an explanation of what is happening there, which we will look at in a little bit more detail in a few minutes' time. But in the end of that parable, 12 verse 9, we get this statement when we read that the tenants took the son and killed him and cast him out of the vineyard. What then, Jesus says, will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. And that's exactly what he's doing. He is coming to reject the old Israel and give the position of being the Israel of God to the new Israel that he has founded based on his 12 disciples. And now we see how the training of the disciples fits in. Because what the training of the disciples is doing is fitting in to the fact that he has been training them to be the new Israel. Right. What we are doing this morning then is not looking at the training of the disciples, not looking at the new Israel being prepared to take the place of the old, but looking at the rejection of the old Israel. And the question which springs to mind is, why were they rejected? What had they done which was so heinous that it deserved a rejection from God? And that brings us naturally at that point onto our third question, which we said the whole study was going to revolve around, which is, what exactly is the battle over? Because what the battle is over will tell us why they were rejected. And that brings us into the detail of the text of this morning's passage, chapter 11, 27 onwards. We start off with three conflict stories with the main religious groups. The first conflict story, which is 11, 27 to 12, 12, we have a conflict with the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. The second conflict story, which is 12, 13 to 17, we have a conflict with the Pharisees and Herodians. And the third conflict story, which is 12, 18 to 27, we have a conflict with the Sadducees. All the major groupings, all the religious groupings in Israel were being dealt with here, one after the other, as Mark goes across a whole spectrum, saying, look, this is who Jesus came to deal with. Not just a sector of Israel, but all the groupings, all the major parts of Israel are for one reason or other dealt with and rejected. So we get then this triplet of conflict stories. And as so often happens in Mark's triplets, the first of the triplet is the longest, because in the first of the triplet, Mark gives the detail of what is happening. And in the second and third items of the triplet, what he is saying is, and in a similar way on this issue, or alternatively, he may be saying, and so we're going to elaborate it down this particular track. And what he's doing, therefore, in the second and third items of a triplet is laying emphasis that it wasn't just a one-off sporadic incident, but a repeated incident. And not just a repeated incident, but developing different themes each time. What then happens in this first conflict story? Well, the story we know, they come to Jesus, they ask him what authority he has. He refuses to answer the question about what authority he has. He says, well, what about John? What authority what authority did John have? They, instead of acknowledging or even asking themselves seriously whether John had authority, duck the question. They go about saying, well, we can't say he had authority, because otherwise he'll say, why do we believe him? We can't say he didn't have authority, because the crowds will then stone us. And the question of whether John had authority or not never comes up in their mind. And so it is with Jesus, which is why he goes on to tell the parable, which is very much a part of this incident, where in the parable, there is no doubt that the tenants knew the authority of the Son. They recognized the Son as heir, and they rejected him because he is heir, saying, "Let us kill him, and then the inheritance will be ours." So there's no question there of dispute and uncertainty over the authority of the Son. The question is over whether or not the tenants will accept the Son's authority, whether or not they will accept the authority of the man who sent his Son. And similarly here, Jesus is saying, the question isn't over whether I have authority to come and teach you. The question is whether you will accept the authority that I do have. To some extent they may recognize it, to some extent they may not. To some extent that isn't the question. The question is whether, having recognized it, they will accept it. And the answer is they will not. Jesus says that in parable, and the chief priests and the elders and the scribes prove it by their action. They prove it by their response when the issue of John comes up. They don't ask whether John has authority. They simply say, how can we squirm out of this question? They prove it when Jesus has finished telling the parable. They don't ask whether there is any validity in what he is saying. They simply say, how can we get out of it? How can we kill him? Isn't that a classic? Isn't that exactly what the tenants in the vineyard did? How can we kill him? The parable also does something else, which we've been looking at briefly. And that is, it states publicly what Jesus has come to do. He has come to seek fruit. And it states publicly what will be the consequences of his failure to find fruit, which is going to be his death and their destruction, and their rejection and their replacement. Remember that what he's been doing so far on that front in the instance about the fig tree have been in private to the disciples. But this isn't. This is in public to the crowds. Okay, let's move on then to the second item in the conflict, the triplet. That's where the Herodians and the Pharisees come together to trap him, because that's what Mark says they came to do, on the issue of taxes to Caesar. It is not a genuine question. Both the Herodians and the Pharisees would probably have accepted the need to pay taxes for different reasons. But paying taxes was unpopular with the crowds. And if Jesus says pay taxes, he would then lose the support of the crowds. If Jesus says no, don't pay taxes, that's an offense they can report him to the authorities over. And what Jesus says is, look, you're again asking the wrong question. The question isn't over what we should do with taxes to Caesar. Pay them. You have implicitly said that you should pay them because you're using Caesar's coin. The question is, and this is where the sting, as so often in Jesus' parables, is in the tail. The sting is, and render to God what is God's. And that is what they were not doing. By the fact that they were coming to entrap him, by the fact that they were not concerned about whether he had any validity, any truth behind him in what he was saying, they were showing that they were not giving to God any hint of belief, any hint of acceptance of the fact he might be God. Right, let's move on then quickly to the third of these triplets, which is where the Sadducees come, trying to disprove the existence of eternity. That's effectively what they're doing, isn't it? I mean, all these stories about there's one wife who has seven husbands, and whose wife will she be? The question isn't whose wife will she be. The question is, well, look, because we've got this superb counterexample which shows that she can't be any of their wives, or she must be all their wives, neither of which can be the case, therefore heaven doesn't exist. And what Jesus says is, look, don't be silly. You just do not understand. You haven't a clue. And you haven't a clue because you know neither scripture nor the power of God. The two really go hand in hand. How can you know the power of God without knowing scripture, without knowing how he has revealed himself in power, what he has revealed of himself, which includes his power through history? How can you know the scriptures without beginning to know something of the God who has worked in power? Now, the Sadducees, we all know because our commentaries tell us so and our Bible dictionaries tell us so, were people who had accepted only the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, and had rejected the rest. And what Jesus is saying is, look, you may have rejected large tracts of the scriptures, but even with what is left of the scriptures, you do not understand them. You do not understand the implication. Because what he does is he proves that eternity exists, heaven exists, the resurrection exists from the Pentateuch. So even from the Pentateuch, which they accepted, they did not understand the existence of the resurrection. A lesson perhaps for liberal academics today who have thrown out large elements of the Bible. But even what they've decided to keep, they do not understand. Right, let's summarize then that triplet. The main problem in all three has been their relationship with God. It is at the heart of their problem. They do not humbly accept his authority. They will not humbly accept his authority. They will not give him what is his by right, his due. They do not know him at all, either experientially or in scripture. And really, I don't think you can separate the two. So this relationship then, which they totally lack, is what is at the heart of Jesus' and God's, therefore, rejection of Israel. Now, it's not surprising at one level that this should be a problem. It is, after all, the fundamental sin. It is what Adam and Eve were rejected in the garden for. It is what all non-Christians, all those who do not know God, are rejected for. It is for not having a relationship with God. So at that level, it is not surprising. They have not accepted authority. They do not give him what is his. They do not want to know anything about him. Well, that's to some extent to be a fallen human. It is striking when you see who he is that he is speaking to. He is not speaking to a Gentile. He is speaking to the religious leaders of God's people, the people with whom God has been dealing for over a millennia. God has sent his prophets, God has taught, God has spoken, God has acted. And they haven't a clue about the nature of God. They haven't a clue about who he is, what he expects, and the way they should relate to him. These were the people who were religiously absolutely punctilious. They dotted their I's, they crossed their T's, they did everything. They were the ones who rebuked Jesus and rejected Jesus because Jesus wasn't being punctilious enough in his performance of religion, in issues such as fasting, who he ate with, use of the law, purity. It was over issues such as these that they rejected Jesus. They did them all, every single thing they did. And what Jesus is saying is, you have totally and utterly missed the point. It is not about religious activity. It is about a relationship with God. We can summarize this part then and begin to answer our question. If you remember, our question was, well, what is the battle over? By saying that the battle is over the lack of fruit that the Son came to find. And the fruit that the Son came to look for was the fruit of faith. And faith is what is lacking. Instead of faith in God, instead of an acceptance of God as who he is, he finds the opposite. He finds a rejection of a supernatural God, a rejection of an omnipotent God, a rejection of an eternal God. It would be nice, wouldn't it, if we could take these three failings, the failing of acceptance of authority, the failing of acceptance of giving him his due, the failing of knowing anything about God, and say, well, one group of people suffered from this, another group of people suffered from that. But it didn't happen then, because the chief priests, the elders and the scribes would have included some Sadducees and some Pharisees. So some of them were suffering at least from two or three of these faults. And so it is today. You can't really separate them. As you look at sectors of the church which we accept suffer from these faults, if we look at, say, liberal academics, who have, in some measure, at least some of them, completely rejected God's authority, have thrown out Scripture and do not know God as He has revealed Himself. You can't say they have only rejected the Scriptures. They have rejected the authority with the Scripture. I think, however, that it is actually more prevalent than just saying it applies only to liberal academics, or it applies only to certain sectors of the religious establishment where they're concerned more about the things of this world, about power and authority and position. I suspect the seeds of it are found far more widely within the church. And this is something we need to think about and perhaps be aware of, whether the seeds, at least, are there, and if unchecked, they will blossom forth, as they did in the religious leaders of Jerusalem, into a faithlessness and a rejection of God so severe that God rejected Israel. Well, if that was what they were doing wrong, how then should they be living? The other question we have to ask is, well, if Mark has said all that in the first three conflict stories, what happens in the rest of the chapter, in the rest of the debates with the scribes and the Pharisees and the rest of them? Well, to some extent, Jesus is elaborating what he is saying. And he is answering the question in the first instance, which we've just asked, how then should they be living? Well, when the scribe comes along and says to Jesus, well, what is the first commandment? Jesus, to some extent, is answering exactly that question. How then should we be living? And he says, we should live by loving the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. Now look at the way that contrasts with what the religious authorities have been living. How can you love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and reject His authority? How can you love God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and not know Him or want to know Him? Conversely, how can you know Him and not love Him? So then, this fourth story is, I think, part of the triplet. Well, it's not strictly part of the triplet, but it's part of that set of stories of which the triplet is the first bit, where the religious authorities come to Jesus in response to what He has done initially in the temple scene, asking Him questions. And note, because it's interesting, that it is after this friendly response that He gives to the scribes when verse 34, Jesus says, when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. By far and away the most friendly response that Jesus gives to anyone in public in Jerusalem. And look then at what Mark says. After that, no one dared to ask him any question. And I think that shows that Mark certainly understood, and the people around him understood, that what Jesus was doing in his answering of the scribes' question about the chief commandment was part of the package that he was criticizing the religious authorities over. He was laying out a standard for the way they should be relating to God and living, which they were falling totally short of. Right. What then happens next? Well, they don't dare come and ask him questions, but that doesn't mean that the battle is over. He now goes into their court. He takes the battle to them. And we have two teaching incidents where he teaches against the scribes. Firstly, we get a teaching against the scribes about what they taught. Now remember that the scribes are the teachers of the people. The scribes are the ones who spent hours and hours burrowing about in the Old Testament, thinking that they were beginning to understand what it was. And what Jesus is saying is, look, you have missed the point. In one of the issues which you have spent most of the time studying, which is who the Messiah is, I mean, this was, after all, a very topical issue. It was something of great interest
They would have spent hours trying to work out who this Messiah was. He says, you have missed the point. You have missed the fact that the Messiah is divine. By thinking he is just David's son, you have made him a man. By thinking he is just David's son, and therefore a man, you have been forced to think that if he is special, he is special because he is a political activist, a political leader. If you had realized he was divine, you might have looked elsewhere. You might have begun to understand what the Messiah actually is. So the scribes then have missed the main point of one of their major areas of study. They have also, in the second story, abused their position. Instead of seeing teaching as an area of service, they have sought to gain honor, gain status, gain reward from the position that God has given them. The magnitude of the crime, obviously, is because they are teachers. When the teachers go astray, then the people will be led astray. By lifestyle, they will follow the example. And if the teachers seek authority, as we saw yesterday, why shouldn't the people? Even more importantly, if the teachers are impoverished in what they teach, how then will the people understand? And so we have here, the people are impoverished in their teaching, and so the people haven't understood. There are obviously real dangers for teachers of the word today in this. Honor from men is pleasant. I like it. I'm sure you like it. We therefore court it. But is that right? I mean, isn't that the exact opposite of what Jesus taught his disciples, as we saw yesterday, and what he is now condemning the scribes for? Just to show that it's not just an optional. As far as teaching is concerned, isn't it easy to be slipshod in our study? Isn't it easy to be so man-centered, to come to the Bible with such man-centered spectacles that we only see from it man's things and therefore miss God's things? It's worth standing back at this point and saying, well, interestingly enough, what Israel is rejected for is exactly the opposite of what Jesus has been teaching the disciples. Israel has been rejected for self-centeredness, self-seeking. Man-centeredness, world-centeredness. I was trying to think of a good word, but there isn't. It's sort of looking at oneself, thinking oneself is important, thinking the world around one is important, thinking man is the measure of all things, if you like. What the disciples have been taught, however, is the importance of faith, the importance of service, the exact opposite of that. That's more or less what you'd expect, isn't it? The old Israel is being rejected for these failings. The new Israel is being taught precisely about the opposite, how to live differently, to overcome. How then does the final story in this morning's passage fit in? Well, in the story of the woman, we get a contrast. Now, we know the story of the woman well, don't we? The woman comes along, she puts her entire livelihood, one penny, into the offering tray. And Jesus says, she has given more than everyone else. Look at the contrast between the woman and the religious authorities. What she was doing, self-centered, man-seeking? No, of course it wasn't. If a man had noticed her put one penny into the offertory, what would man have thought? Would man have thought, how generous? No, of course not. Man would have thought, how stingy, how mingy, just one penny. Couldn't she have given more than that? Not knowing that that was all she had to give. So it wasn't unlike the scribes and the Pharisees. For the praise of man that she was giving her penny, it was for the praise of God. Look at what it must have taken to give her whole livelihood. Isn't that an expression of precisely what Jesus has been teaching as the first commandment, a love of God with all one's heart, soul, mind, and strength? Isn't that the sort of response you'd expect from someone who is loving God with all one's heart, soul, mind, and strength. And therefore we get a contrast, and with a contrast, perhaps an element of a hint of cheer. Though the religious authorities are totally corrupt, though they do not have a clue about God, yet there are individuals around who do. Let us notice also that this final incident is not to the crowds. That is to the disciples. Mark has been making this clear when he went in verse 37, teaching about the scribes. He pointedly says, "And the great throng heard him gladly." The attack on the scribes was not done undercover. It was done for all to see. The judgment and the rejection was public. When he teaches about the woman and praises her, however, he says, verse 43, "And he called his disciples to him and said to them." Because commending the woman for the way she was living was part of the training of the new Israel. Let us begin to summarize and draw some of our threads together. The battle then is over faith, their lack of it. They should have been living with God at the center of their lives. They should have been seeking to please Him. They should have been seeking His praise, honor from Him, accepting His authority, seeking to know Him. Instead, they were living with themselves at the center of their life. They were seeking to rule their own lives, to gain and get for themselves, to receive praise from men. And what do they do to vindicate this absolute distinction between God's way and man's way? Why? They create a man-centered, God-excluding theology, which says man is the center. Now, isn't that what happens today? Don't we create in our pride, as they created in their pride, a man-centered, God-excluding theology to vindicate our man-centeredness? Now, obviously, such a man-centeredness is totally incompatible with the relationship with God that God requires and demands, that Jesus came looking for. And so they were rejected. The bottom line, if you like. No faith, rejection. Now, we see also, standing back slightly, that this is a climax of another theme. We saw it as being the climax of the theme of conflict. We see it also now as the climax of the theme of true versus false religion, a theme which we have seen time and time again, often linked with the idea of conflict. And now we have this whole set of incidents about false versus true religion climaxing that. It is not just a subject for debate. It is not just a subject for argument. It is a subject that when they get it wrong, they are rejected for. So, where does that leave us today then? Do we today live a man-centered sort of religion? Well, yes, the answer must be yes. You can see it all around you. In the emphasis on the ceremonial in the Catholic Church, isn't there a man-centeredness there? Man the minister, man the priest, man the one who performs the ceremonies for man, the recipient of the ceremony. For man's good. Don't we see it in the emphasis on religious experience? I and what I feel matter. If it doesn't seem right to me, if it doesn't feel right to me, it's wrong, it's not important. Isn't this exacerbated by the way we sell the gospel? Become a Christian, we say, because it makes you feel great. It solves all your problems. I'm caricaturizing, of course, but you know what I mean. Don't we, in the way we present our gospel, not present it as a gospel about a God who is out there, objectively existing, ruling the world which He created? Aren't we instead presenting a Christianity, in quotes, which is man-centered, about solving man's needs? Don't you see a third example in the emphasis on social action, really a subsuming of Christianity to man's priorities, solving man's problems man's way to reach man's goals. Where is God in that, apart from a tool? Obviously, a concern for the poor springs out of a right relationship with God. That surely must be part of loving our neighbor. But so often in what we see in our social action is not a loving out of a loving of one's neighbor following on from a love of God with all one's heart, soul, mind, and strength. It is a loving of one's neighbor as an expression of what I want. It eases my conscience in the culture we live in to look to man's needs, and therefore I soothe my conscience and look to man's needs. Now all these, of course, this man-centeredness of religion is something which has always occurred. It must always occur because it is part of the sin which led to the rejection of Adam and Eve. It is, however, I think, something which is becoming more prevalent in our time and age. And it's becoming more prevalent because whereas man has always rejected the one true living God, man has begun over the last century or so to reject all the supernatural as well. Rejecting all the supernatural, and therefore any hint of God, we're driven to a more and more man-centered existence. You can see this in the various philosophies which have crept up over the last century to describe and explain the man-centeredness of the world around us, which in their turn reinforce the man-centeredness of the world around us. Look at existentialism. Man, it says, is the measure of all things. Man chooses. If man doesn't choose, it doesn't exist. Look at it in a materialist or an empiricist philosophy. Is it not there at the bed of it, bedrock of these philosophies? Is it not at the bedrock or implicit within many of the philosophies of today which describe the culture of the age we live in? And as this culture creeps into the church, which is what it is doing, so within the church we're becoming more man-centered. It starts with a man in the street, it goes on to the liberal don in Cambridge, and then it reaches the Christian in the pew. And the Christian in the pew begins to think, if it doesn't affect me, if it doesn't help me, then it isn't important, it doesn't exist. What other examples do we have there? A few which occurred to me are the desire that so many Christians have today for wealth, power, self-satisfaction, the praise of man. Isn't that man-centeredness? Of course it is. It's almost tautological to say it's man-centeredness. What about the lack of inclination to serve? And in particular, I'm sure this is true in your church, the more humble the service, the harder it is to find someone to serve. Why? Because we're not interested in God seeing the service and God honoring. We're interested in man seeing the service and man honoring. Man-centeredness. Look at the problems, the lack of inclination for prayer, particularly private prayer, where man doesn't see, only God sees. Obviously, a man-centeredness is not the only reason why prayer is hard or why we find prayer difficult and we don't pray. But I think one of the reasons why it's becoming more and more of a problem is because of this man-centeredness that says, if it's not for me, either directly or because you see that I have done something great, wonderful, and holy, and therefore honor me for it, then it's not important. Now, I thought of these examples by just looking at the church in our time and saying, well, what are the problems where we have man-centeredness at its heart instead of God-centeredness. Having written them down and having issues like the desire for wealth and honor, the lack of inclination to serve, the lack of prayer, don't we see that these are exactly the issues which Jesus has been teaching his disciples over? We've seen teaching on prayer in chapter 9. We will see it again in this morning's study in chapter 11. We've seen teaching on service throughout the middle chapters of, and particularly the last couple of chapters of Mark. We have seen teaching on the need not to seek honor and status and praise from man, again, throughout the last couple of chapters. So really, what we're saying is precisely what Jesus has been teaching the disciples against, we find prevalent in our church today, a reflection of the false religion which has crept in, for which Israel was judged. Now, in conclusion, I'd just like to make two quick points. The first is that it is not surprising that the authorities wanted Jesus dead. Look at what he had done. He had taught against everything they stood for, everything they held dear, everything that was important to them. He had taught that in public, making it clear that Israel was being rejected for this. If you were the authorities, would you not want him dead? Yes, of course we want him dead. They want him dead. So to some extent, the killing of him, which had been planned in 3 verse 6, now becomes even more of an inevitability. And finally, is it surprising that when the disciples follow his pattern in teaching in this way and serving in this way, they will suffer too? Yes, of course it is. And that's why he's been teaching them and will continue to teach them about the fact that persecution and suffering is an inevitable part of true Christian teaching and Christian service. Because true Christian teaching and Christian service consists in pointing out to the world around us and the religious establishment around us, when it falls short and turns away from God in a rejection of faith, that it is wrong. And just as the disciples then would suffer for that, so we will suffer for that today if we do the same. So let us summarize very briefly then where we've got to. There is a battle in these chapters, in these verses of this chapter. The battle is over their lack of faith. It's over their false religion. And because of their lack of faith, because of their false religion, Israel is rejected, and the new Israel will replace it. That's all I want to say.